Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. We're a network of about 60, a little over 60 scholars, Christian scholars, all evangelical Christian scholars, at various universities and research institutes sprinkled around North America. About a third of us are natural scientists, especially focusing on environmental science and on climate science. We are among the Neanderthals with our knuckles dragging on the ground who think that the notion of man-made global warming so dangerous as to justify spending trillions of dollars to try to mitigate it is not well supported by empirical evidence. That doesn't mean that we deny all human contribution to the temperature of the globe. We think that that's pretty basic physics. But the notion that it is dangerous, that it's large magnitude, we think doesn't fit with the empirical evidence. But at any rate, we're about a third natural scientists, about a third are economists, with two specialties dominating in among those. One is environmental economists, and the other are developmental economists, the one focusing on the economics of how we steward the environment, the other focusing on the economics of how societies rise and stay out of poverty and how they develop their economies. And then the other third of us are theologians and pastors and ethicists. I'm in the last category, but I also do so much reading in the other categories that I have the fun of sort of integrating the work of all of these men together to do three things simultaneously. The first is to promote biblical earth stewardship, or what we also call godly dominion, which I'll be describing in more detail later on in this lecture. And the second is to promote economic development for the very poor around the world. Think in terms of places like sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia and Latin America. And the third is the proclamation and defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we do all of this in a world that is permeated by an environmental movement whose worldview, theology, and ethics are overwhelmingly anti-Christian, whose economics and science are typically fairly poorly done, whose policies, therefore, typically do not really do much to protect the natural environment, but do harm the poor around the world by slowing, stopping, or even reversing economic development, trapping people in poverty for long periods of time. And finally, whose doctrines of God, creation, humanity, sin, and salvation tend to be very much contrary to those of the Christian faith, but that is infiltrating Christian churches quite intentionally, indeed is supported by hundreds of millions of dollars of funding from very large left-wing foundations to efforts to infiltrate Christian churches and, as they call it, green the gospel. And so I'll be talking a bit about that in this lecture as well. So let's now think a little bit about how the environmental movement challenges the Christian church. I want to start by asking you to see if you can imagine who might say something like this and where this person might live. Quoting now, "Population growth is the key causative of climate change and its negative impacts. Unless we adopt a multi-faith approach to sensitizing our people on the dangers of careless population growth, we will lose the climate change fight. We must tell our people to control human procreation." I think a little bit about who might say something like that. Surely he must live in one of the world's more densely populated countries. Maybe Bangladesh, with about 2,850 people per square mile, or Taiwan with 1,849 per square mile, or South Korea with 1,288, or India with 954. Well, guess again. He lives in Malawi, population density only about 358 per square mile, or about an eighth of Bangladesh's. It's even below the density of many wealthy countries with clean and healthful environments, like Belgium at 889, or the United Kingdom at 650, or Germany at 609, not to mention Singapore with 18,645 people per square mile. So why does he think Malawi suffers from overpopulation? Well, here's a clue. It has nothing to do with demographic numbers. Not density, not growth rate, not age distribution, not dependency ratio. It's because Malawi's overpopulation, he thinks, contributes to global warming. Really? Let's get some hard figures here for a minute. In 2009, Malawi's total CO2 emissions amounted to about 0.004 of 1% of total world emissions. That's total world human emissions, which themselves make only a small fraction of total world emissions. Natural emissions outweigh human by a long shot. Even on the alarmist's assumption that doubled atmospheric CO2 concentration would cause about 5.4 Fahrenheit degrees of warming, that would make Malawi's contribution less than 0.017 of 1 degree in the roughly 100 years needed for that warming to occur. Can anyone seriously think even eliminating Malawi's entire population and with it, all its CO2 emissions would have the slightest impact on global average temperature, or for that matter, on Malawi's own climate? It's not just where the person who said this lives, but also who he is that is sadly ironic. He's Reverend Nansen Zonda, General Secretary for the Church of African Presbytery, and he supposedly speaks for a broad array of Malawian evangelical leaders. Now, where did Reverend Zonda get his ideas on population and climate? Well, according to the report of his speech in the Nyasa Times, he got it from the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And that thinking ultimately stems from environmentalists who cooperate with the population control movement to dub low-density regions populated by people of color, such as sub-Saharan Africa, with its average population density of about 36 people per square mile, overpopulated, despite there being less than a third as densely populated as, for example, Europe, at 134 people per square mile. African church leaders must not be led astray by the bad science and economics of either global warming alarmists or population alarmists. Instead, they need to celebrate people, their people, as the image of God. Today I'm going to be talking with you about what I've come to believe after over 25 years of study is the most dangerous threat to family, church, and Western civilization in our time. The challenges it brings us, and how together we can rise to the challenge and turn it into a great opportunity. I'll give you a big picture, wide-ranging view of a spiritual world war, and urge you to take up spiritual arms to fight it. I'll break the talk into three parts. As a child in the 1950s, I lived in Calcutta, India. Two of my earliest memories come from there. One is of a beautiful red flowering vine hanging from a tree in the courtyard of the apartment complex in which we lived. From that, I learned early on the beauty of God's wonderful creation. The other is of the dead bodies over which early every morning for a while I would have to step as my ayah, my nurse, took me from my parents' apartment several blocks to an Indian home where I spent the day because my father was working and my mother was paralyzed by a tropical virus. We were out so early, the trucks hadn't come around yet to pick up the bodies of those who had died of starvation and disease overnight. And from that, I learned the early, I learned the devastating effects of poverty. Now, those two lessons have stuck with me all my life. In writing several books in the field, in drafting what became the Cornwall Declaration on Environmental Stewardship, and in founding later the Cornwall Alliance and leading that, I seek to implement those lessons to promote simultaneously biblical earth stewardship and economic development for the world's poorest. Because poverty robs the poor of health and life, and because not the poor themselves, but poverty, not affluence, is the environment's number one enemy, I consider the relief of poverty one of the most important steps we can take, both to improve our neighbors' lives and to care for the earth. A newspaper reporter once asked me what I thought biblical environmental stewardship would look like. I responded that on the basis of Genesis 1:28, which says that after having created them, male and female, in his own image, God blessed Adam and Eve, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over everything that moves on the face of the earth." It would look like people made in the image of God, reflecting God's own creativity, working together lovingly to enhance the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth for the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors, thus tying together the two great commandments to love God and to love neighbor. For example, I told this newspaper reporter, 300 years ago, the average yield per grain of wheat sown was 4 grains. Today, it's hundreds. Now, that astonishing increase in yield came from our exercising godly dominion over the soil through better methods of cultivation, fertilization, and irrigation, over the weeds, insects, and diseases through herbicides, insecticides, and fungicides, and even over the very wheat grains themselves through careful breeding and, more recently, genetic engineering. Farmers exercising godly dominion over the earth not only makes food more abundant and nourishing and affordable for everyone, especially for the poor, and so prevents hunger and starvation, but also means we don't need to farm nearly so much land to feed the same number of people. And that's good not just for people, but also for ecosystems and all the creatures that live in them. Now, this is an important difference between environmentalism and biblical earth stewardship, what I call godly dominion. Today I want to unfold for you, first, what I believe it means to live out the dominion mandate of Genesis 1:28. Second, how most of the environmental movement undermines that mandate and robs us of its blessings. And third, how to recover it. Now, some people are surprised when I speak negatively and broadly of environmentalism, so let me explain why I do. Historically, the word environmentalism arose in the 1970s as a new term to denote the preservationist movement, which in the 1950s and 1960s took over and transformed the old conservationist movement. Conservationism aimed to make wise use of the earth to meet human needs now and in future generations. Preservationism embraced pioneering ecologist Barry Commoner's third law of ecology, namely, nature knows best. And this implies that earth is best unchanged from the state in which we find it. Now, second, etymologically, the word environmentalism comes from a French word meaning surroundings. And no matter how hard I try, I can't think of anything that doesn't make up our surroundings. Essentially, environment means everything. It follows that environmentalism means everything-ism. And as political scientist Charles Rubin put it in his book, The Green Crusade, everything-ism equates with totalitarianism. Environmentalism, then, is inherently totalitarian in character, which explains why federal and state environmental protection agencies seem to claim authority to regulate more and more of our lives, regardless of constitutional safeguards for liberty and property. And finally, I believe we must do our best to use biblical terms for biblical activities. Environmentalism not only isn't a biblical term, it doesn't describe a truly biblical idea. Stewardship of the earth would be better, but my personal preference is to speak of godly dominion. Dominion, because that's the term used in Genesis 1:28, the most important text on the subject, and godly because it distinguishes true dominion from the careless, rapacious, abusive activity that some people wrongly equate with dominion. Now let's move on. A little historical background tied to an analysis of two great creation themes in Genesis 1:27 and 28 will help you see the situation we're in, the challenges it presents, and how, working together, we can turn those challenges into opportunities. Genesis 1:27 reveals the essence of man. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Man is the image of God, and man is male and female. And from these truths flow all truths about man's relationship with and duties toward God and other men, and particularly about sexuality, marriage, and procreation. Verse 28 expands on the mission of man. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over everything in it." God's mission for man, male and female, is to multiply and fill the earth, and, filling it, to subdue and rule it. Not to abuse it, but to rule it as God does, enhancing its fruitfulness, its safety, and its beauty, to the glory of God and the benefit of our fellow men. But these two ideas, multiplication and dominion, are the nemeses of environmentalism. Believing that we have overpopulated the earth, and so our multiplication has become a curse, not a blessing. I wish I could take dominion over this fly. Want to subdue that little beastie. Yeah. Believing that we have overpopulated the earth, and so our multiplication has become a curse, not a blessing. Environmentalists attack the first part. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And following the lead of eco-historian Lynn White Jr., who argued in his 1967 Science magazine article, "The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis," that Judaism and Christianity justified ecological abuse by appeal to this verse, they attack its second part, "Subdue it and have dominion over it." Sad to say, even some Christians now have come to view having more than one or two children as irresponsible, despite Psalm 127's teaching that children, lots of them, are a blessing from the Lord. Unaware that the church has not interpreted Genesis 1:28 as justifying abusing the earth, they have forced a false interpretation on it, transforming man's role from ruler to slave of the earth. As a result, many Christian environmentalists, advocates of what they call creation care, and frankly, there's nothing wrong with that term, it's just that it has been taken over by a group whose thinking is far too often influenced more by the world than by the scriptures. Even many Christian environmentalists now undermine the message of Genesis 1:28. They have borrowed without discernment from a broader worldview, not recognizing it as part of a spiritual world war focused on undermining faith in Genesis 1:27 and 28. But many proponents of creation care obscure this mandate by reinterpreting Genesis 2:15, which says God placed Adam in the Garden of Eden to cultivate and guard it, and then transferring their interpretation of that to Genesis 1:28. Their reinterpretation of Genesis 2:15 involves two mistakes. First, they assume that Adam was to work and what Adam was to work and keep there in 2:15 was not just the Garden of Eden, but the whole earth. But the text specifically says that God placed him in the garden to cultivate and guard it. Second, noting that the Hebrew avav usually here translated work, dress, cultivate, or tend, can mean serve. They grasp that meaning and insist that it's the right one here. But avad means serve only when its direct object is personal, not when its object is impersonal. You serve other persons. You do not serve a cow or a table or a rock. Nonetheless, they insist that Genesis 2:15 says man should serve and keep not just the garden, but the whole earth. And suddenly the idea from Genesis 2:15 becomes almost identical to the preservationist idea of environmentalism. And then they insist that serve and keep in Genesis 2:15 restates and controls the meaning of subdue and have dominion in Genesis 1:28. Despite the fact that the verbs in the two verses have very different meanings. Subdue translates the Hebrew kabosh, from which we get our Yiddish kabosh, put the kabosh on something, right? Subdue translates kabosh, meaning to bring into bondage, to subdue or force, to dominate. And have dominion over translates the Hebrew radah, to rule, to dominate. Now, while I would certainly not say that evangelical proponents of creation care intentionally misinterpret Genesis 1:28, I'm convinced that their mistaken understandings arise partly because they have borrowed, without discernment, from a broader worldview heavily shaped by the environmental and population control movements. And I'm convinced that those two movements are aspects of a spiritual world war that focuses on undermining faith in these two verses, Genesis 1:27 and 28. The environmental movement, with over 1 million formal and informal organizations worldwide, the 10 largest of which alone have combined annual budgets in the multiple billions of dollars, which they spend almost exclusively on marketing their message, has in the last 20 years especially targeted the world's religious communities, churches, synagogues, mosques, temples, and more, infiltrating them to green their messages. Here in the United States, 24 years ago, the National Religious Partnership for the Environment formed, equipped by multi-million dollar grants from large progressive foundations like Ford, Rockefeller, Pew, Hewlett, Tides, Heinz, and George Soros's Open Society Foundations, which later came onto the bandwagon and started supporting NRPE as well. And it was co-founded by the Reverend James Parks Morton, the Dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City, an Episcopal cathedral, a New Ager who held baptismal ceremonies for animals, and by the atheist Marxist astronomer Dr. Carl Sagan, who introduced each episode of his phenomenally popular Cosmos program on public television by saying, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be," intentionally borrowing and mocking language from God's description of himself in the book of Revelation as the one who is and who was and who is to come. The Evangelical Environmental Network, born in the offices of progressive left evangelical Ronald J. Sider's Evangelicals for Social Action, is the evangelical branch of the NRPE and benefits from the massive funding from those foundations, all of which have, for decades, been major supporters of incentivized and sometimes forced sterilization and abortion as methods of government-organized family planning for the purpose of population control, like China's one-child policy, and whose support of environmentalist causes is intended in part to promote that. Environmentalism, as Robert Nelson argued conclusively in his outstanding book, The New Holy Wars, Economic Religion versus Environmental Religion in Contemporary America, is a full-blown religion with its own doctrines of God, creation, humanity, sin, and salvation. It is also, in my estimation, the greatest threat to the survival of Western civilization and its institutions of the rule of law, of government by the consent of the governed, and of the protection, however incomplete and flawed, of God-given rights to life, liberty, and property in the West. Environmentalism is such a great threat because, first, unlike the Soviet Union and its satellites in the Cold War, and unlike Islamic Jihad today, which were or are external and clearly recognized as enemies by the overwhelming majority of people in the free world, environmentalism is internal, and people think of it as friend, not foe. Second, because unlike arid and nihilistic secular humanism, environmentalism speaks to the inherent spiritual yearnings of human souls and provides plausible answers to dogged questions about how we got here, what causes suffering, and how suffering might come to an end. And third, because it incorporates the strengths of all three of those other threats: the utopian vision of Marxism, the scientific facade of secular humanism, and the religious fanaticism of jihad. And fourth, because it encompasses all those vague spiritualities that have now already overwhelmed secular humanism and threatened the Christian faith in the repaganization of the West through the import of the ideas of the East. Dark green religion, as nature religionist Bron Taylor names the many strands of religious environmentalism in the title of his brilliant book, divinizes and resacralizes nature and so subjugates mankind to her, turning upside down the order revealed in Scripture when Elohim, after creating Adam and Eve in his image, appointed them and their descendants his representatives, blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and rule it." In short, the worldwide environmental movement today unites pagan religion, ecological utopianism, and socialist politics and economics to create a vision for a global government that is the conscious goal of those who lead it. Like the United Nations Earth Charter, which I wish that I had time to take you on a tour of, but we don't, the environmental movement seeks a fundamental transformation of the values, institutions, and practices on which modern civilization has rested. 100 years ago, about 50 years after Darwin's Origin of Species, the Darwinist movement had grown large and powerful enough to challenge the Christian teaching that previously prevailed not only in American churches, but throughout American society, including the public schools. Darwinism attacked Genesis 1:27. God created man in his own image, male and female. The result has been the tragic undermining of human dignity and the growing prevalence of all kinds of depravity, including abortion and euthanasia, which attack the sanctity of human life, and homosexuality and transgenderism, which attack the God-ordained sexual differences and roles of human life. Now, my friends, listen to me carefully. This is the truth. Today, just about 50 years after the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which in many ways was the great spring, so to speak, of the modern environmentalist movement, the Christian church stands with regard to environmentalism where it stood a century ago with regard to Darwinism. At that time, some Christians strove valiantly. Some were deceived. Some were unaware. And some capitulated to Darwin's attack on Genesis 1:27. We largely lost that battle, and the sad consequences are obvious all around us. Our response today to environmentalism's attack on Genesis 1:28 must be better. To restore the teaching and reclaim the blessings of Genesis 1:28, we must exercise a wise, courageous, powerful, spiritual warfare, tearing down ideological strongholds, taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. Now, earlier I told you about the astounding 200-fold improvement in wheat yields. What are some other blessings that come from obeying Genesis 1:28? For you really to appreciate them, let me paint quick and simple pictures for you of mankind's past and present. From a few generations after the flood in Noah's day, for the rest of the thousands of years of human history until just 200 years ago, Almost all people everywhere lived in abject poverty, on less than the equivalent of $1.25 a day. Their main cooking and heating fuels were wood and dried dung, smoke from which even today kills over 1 million people a year in developing countries who do not have access to electricity. Almost all transportation was by foot, and what wasn't had accidental injury and death rates sky high compared with today's. Slash and burn was the main agricultural method, resulting in terrible deforestation like what transformed Lebanon, famous in David and Solomon's times for its magnificent cedar forests, into a desert. Waterborne, smokeborne, insectborne, rodentborne, and spoiled foodborne diseases, along with hunger, stalked every land on earth. Nearly half of all children died before their first birthday, and life expectancy at birth was around 27 or 28 years. No one enjoyed the benefits of water purification, sewage sanitation, antibiotics or other medicinal drugs, electricity, and all the wonders that come with that, from lights to work and learn by, to power to run assembly lines, to refrigeration and air conditioning, to MRIs and computers. In the 2 centuries since then, in developed countries, real income has increased by a factor of about 16, and the standard of living it can buy has increased by a factor of about 190. That is, the average person in developed countries today is about 190 times better off than almost every person on earth 2 centuries ago. While some abject poverty continues, and it should move our hearts to compassion and our hands to action, the share of the world's people living in extreme poverty has fallen from nearly half in 1990 to under one-fifth today, lower than at any time in history and rapidly declining, though environmentalism, not biblical earth stewardship or godly dominion, but environmentalism, constitutes a serious threat to reverse that trend. Our main cooking and heating fuel now is clean electricity, mostly from natural gas, coal, and nuclear, all of them hundreds and nuclear thousands of times cleaner than burning wood and dried dung. Almost all transportation now is by car or truck, plane, train, or ship, and much safer and scores to hundreds of times faster. Cropland in developed countries has been improving in quality for over 70 years and is hundreds of times more productive. Because we've greatly reduced hunger and the causes of the diseases that brought the most deaths 2 centuries ago, life expectancy is near 80 in developed countries, over 65 in developing countries, and nowhere below 40. But this progress can be stopped or even reversed. The green movement threatens to trap the poor in poverty and rob people of property rights by touting false or exaggerated claims of eco-disaster, creating constantly expanding oppressive government while weakening sovereign states by pushing us toward global government. Environmentalists ask us to imagine eco-utopias where we enjoy all the benefits of modern industrial civilization without the industry. But those benefits can't be achieved without industry. Yet many leading environmentalists would like to abandon industrial civilization itself altogether to live, as they put it, in harmony with nature, as they mistakenly think our ancestors did. No, for our ancestors' life was indeed, as Thomas Hobbes described it, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, and nature was to be feared because it had not been subdued. Would any of you want to go back to seeing half your children die before age 5 because of disease or hunger? Of course not. But that's the consequence of the real world to which much environmentalism wants us to return. Well, we've looked now at environmentalism's threat to political liberty and material prosperity. I turn now to 2 other threats, to science and to Christian faith and practice. Environmentalism threatens the integrity of science and therefore the benefits of the technology that rests on it. This is relevant to the spiritual world war on Genesis 1, 27 through 28, because science is one of our most important tools in fulfilling the dominion mandate to subdue and rule the earth. And what is undermining it is a particular sort of irrationalism. As Rodney Stark wrote in The Triumph of Reason, How Christianity Led to Freedom, Capitalism, and Western Success, real science, the kind of science that depends on rational and, insofar as humanly possible, objective observation of the real world around us that is not merely a construct of our consciousness, but the product of God's consciousness, independent of us, though dependent on Him, real science arose only once, in Europe. Further, the Christian image of God is that of a rational being who believes in human progress, more fully revealing himself as humans gain the capacity to better understand. Moreover, because God is a rational being and the universe is his personal creation, it necessarily has a rational, lawful structure awaiting increasing human comprehension. This was the key to many intellectual undertakings, among them the rise of science. Stark goes on. Christians developed science because they believed it could be done and should be done. Newton, Kepler, and Galileo regarded the creation itself as a book that was to be read and comprehended. In contrast, Stark pointed out, most non-Christian religions do not posit a creation at all. The universe is eternal, and while it may pursue cycles, it is without beginning or purpose, and most important of all, having never been created, it has no creator. Consequently, the universe is thought to be a supreme mystery, inconsistent, unpredictable, and arbitrary. For those holding these religious premises, the path to wisdom is through meditation and mystical insights, and there is no occasion to celebrate reason. The English mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead wrote that science arose in Europe because faith in the possibility of science was derivative from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God. In Whitehead's estimation, other religions' ideas of God or gods could not sustain such an understanding of the universe. On their presuppositions, any occurrence might be due to the fiat of an irrational despot or some impersonal, inscrutable origin of things. There is not the same confidence, said Whitehead, as in the intelligible rationality of a personal being. Consistent with the prevalence of mysticism in environmental thought, many environmental scientists today practice and promote what is called postnormal science. Now, postnormal science is essentially postmodern deconstructionism, which claimed that language doesn't convey meaning or truth, but merely projects power, to science, resulting in researchers going through the motions of science but with preconceived conclusions to serve a predetermined agenda. Mike Hume is a stellar example of a postnormal scientist. Professor of climate change, note that title, not of climate, but of climate change, at the University of East Anglia, the home of the infamous ClimateGates climatic research unit, in which capacity Hume has taught many of the world's leading climate alarmist scientists and leading contributor to the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Hume is also the author of the book Why We Disagree About Climate Change. In short, though not much known to the public, Mike Hume is more important to the climate alarmist movement than such better-known people as Al, I sold my TV channel to Al-Qaeda supporting Al Jazeera for oil money from Qatar because I didn't want it falling into the hands of someone with the values of Glenn Beck Gore. And James, fossil fuel company executives should be put on trial for crimes against humanity, Hansen, and Michael Hockey Stick Mann. Much as we might disagree with Hume's views on catastrophic anthropogenic global warming and reject his post-normal science, however, we should be thankful for his candor. For here are just five of many representative things he wrote in that book that reveal his commitment to post-normal science. And here I'm quoting. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a classic example of a post-normal scientific activity. Self-evidently dangerous climate change will not emerge from a normal scientific process of truth-seeking. Scientists and politicians must trade truth for influence. The function of climate change really is not about stopping climate chaos. Instead, we need to see how we can use the idea of climate change to rethink how we take forward our political, social, economic, and personal projects over the decades to come. The idea of climate change should be seen as an intellectual resource around which our collective and personal identities and projects can form and take shape. We need to ask, waxing Kennedy-esque here, we need to ask not what we can do for climate change, but what climate change can do for us. Because the idea of climate change is so plastic, it can be deployed across many of our human projects and can serve many of our psychological, ethical, and spiritual needs. And finally, within a capitalist world order, climate change is actually a convenient phenomenon to come along. My friends, the global warming juggernaut is how environmentalists are promoting both socialism and global government by means of post-normal science. And post-normal science is first and foremost the attempt to project power by claiming consensus among scientists. It is as collectivist about alleged scientific facts as socialism is about economic production. And because it draws conclusions based on climate models, regardless of real-world observations, it is also as irrational as pagan mysticism. Now, having described for you some of the threats to liberty, prosperity, and science, let me now address environmentalism's most important threat to the Christian faith and practice in Christian churches. I offer you three examples. Its threat to the gospel and Christian ethics, its threat to biblical authority, and its threat to the pro-life movement. First, it threatens the gospel and Christian ethics. Books like Matthew Sleeth's Serve God, Save the Planet, and The Gospel According to the Earth, and Jonathan Merritt's book, Green Like God, and even HarperCollins's The Green Bible, implicitly change the gospel from Jesus Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, he was buried and he rose again from the dead on the third day according to the scriptures, as Paul summarized it in 1 Corinthians 15, to something like, if you love God, take good care of the earth. Now it's true that if you love God, you will try to take good care of the earth, and I encourage you to do exactly that. But that's not gospel, that's law. And law cannot give life. By obscuring this distinction, the evangelical environmental movement threatens to obscure the gospel and thus rob the church of her greatest treasure. Now, some creation care books, like Jim Ball's Global Warming and the Risen Lord, and Ben Lowe's Green Revolution, Coming Together to Care for Creation, get the gospel right, but turn all kinds of environmentalist desiderata, recycling, using compact fluorescent light bulbs, not trespassing on the wilderness, eating only organic and locally grown foods, into moral imperatives, substituting the traditions of men for the commandments of God, sometimes even contradicting the commandments of God, and so becoming what the Apostle Paul warned about in Colossians 2, 20 through 23, when he wrote, if with Christ you died to the elemental spirits of the world, why, as if you were still alive in the world, do you submit to regulations? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch, referring to things that all perish as they are used, according to human precepts and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-made religion and asceticism and severity to the body, but they are of no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh. The grave danger of the Church of Jesus Christ is that so-called Christian environmentalism can become a new legalism, either a false gospel of justification by works rather than by faith, or if not actually a false gospel, still a man-made ascetic ethic not grounded in what the Bible calls the perfect law of liberty. Now, second, the greening of the church undermines biblical authority. I was an invited plenary lecturer for the 2012 annual meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, the theme of which was Care of Creation. I challenged some widespread environmental beliefs, including catastrophic anthropogenic global warming. Two New Testament scholars, also plenary speakers, were shocked that I would challenge the, quote, 98% of all climate scientists, unquote, who affirm catastrophic anthropogenic global warming. Well, I don't challenge that consensus because it doesn't exist. The survey on which that figure was based was sent to 10,257 Earth scientists. 3,146 responded, and the responses of only 79, those who, quote, listed climate science as their area of expertise and who also have published more than 50% of their recent peer-reviewed papers on the subject of climate change, unquote, and that is a highly incestuous group that carefully controls access to the refereed journals, only those 79 were counted in calculating the 98% of climate scientists, thus excluding literally thousands from the count. The survey asked only two questions. Question one, when compared with pre-1800s levels, do you think that mean global temperatures have generally risen, fallen, or remained relatively constant? Question two, do you think human activity is a significant contributing factor in changing mean global temperatures? Now, I know scores of atmospheric, oceanic, solar, geologic, geographic, and yes, climate scientists who deny dangerous man-made global warming. I don't know a single one who would have answered either of those questions in a way that didn't go along with the so-called consensus. Those questions were guaranteed to return the desired answer. Respondents weren't asked, do you think human activity is the primary contributing factor? Or do you think anthropogenic warming has been or will become catastrophic? Or do you think the benefits of mitigating future warming will outweigh the costs of that mitigation? Those are the debated questions, and those the survey completely ignored. But it doesn't matter for two reasons. First, as Georgia Tech professor of climatology and IPCC author Judith Curry points out, a spontaneous consensus might be a good indicator of where scientific research is leading, but a sought consensus is not. And the IPCC's consensus on climate change has most certainly been sought, often by bullying tactics that intimidate dissent and bar it from publication. Second, as philosopher of science Robert Merton pointed out, consensus isn't a scientific value. The real scientific value is skepticism. Nonetheless, those two other speakers, those two New Testament scholars, both of whose work in New Testament exegesis I admire, objected to my saying these things. They said that on those issues, theologians, quote, know nothing, unquote, and therefore must, quote, trust the scientists, unquote. As if no theologians knew anything about the issue. As I pointed out in the panel discussion, I do. At that point, I had read over 45 books on the science of global warming, over 35 books on the economics of climate change policy, and thousands of articles on each subject, hundreds of them refereed. Or as if all scientists agreed. They don't. And as if consensus mattered in science. It doesn't. Now, third, the creation care movement threatens the pro-life movement. The largest and most influential creation care organization, the Evangelical Environmental Network, heavily funded by the pro-abortion and pro-population control Rockefeller Brothers Fund, has argued that reducing mercury emissions from power plants is pro-life. Depending uncritically on refuted studies, it claims that 1 in 6 American infants in the womb is at risk of, quote, devastating permanent brain damage, unquote, because of those emissions. It praised as sensitive to pro-life concerns members of Congress who supported new mercury regulations, even some with 100% pro-abortion voting records. It questioned the pro-life commitment of members of Congress who opposed the regulations, even some with 100% pro-life voting records. Its campaign risked obscuring the meaning of pro-life, dividing the pro-life movement, and hampering efforts to elect more pro-life members of Congress. Since that time, by the way, they've done the same kind of a campaign with regard to efforts to eliminate, to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. Those who support those efforts are pro-life. Those who oppose them are not pro-life. But as Cornwall Alliance scholars documented in our major study, The Cost of Good Intentions, The Ethics and Economics of the War on Conventional Enemy, the number exposed to any mercury from power plant emissions is more on the order of 1 in 1,000 than 1 in 6. The actual risk to those exposed is not of devastating permanent brain damage, but of a delay in neurological development that is so slight that only a trained specialist using specifically targeted tests can detect it. It disappears in most by age 2 and in almost all by age 7, and amounts to less than 0.5 point reduction in IQ in those in whom it persists, a reduction less than commonly observed in identical twins raised in the same household. In stark contrast to the effort to curb abortion, none is at risk of death. And perhaps most important, none of the harm, whatever it is intentionally inflicted, as it is in abortion. Now, in response, over 30 top leaders of the nation's most prominent pro-life organizations endorsed a statement prepared by the Cornwall Alliance, protecting the unborn and the pro-life movement from a misleading environmentalist tactic, repudiating the campaign. And recently we put out a similar statement that was endorsed also by many pro-life leaders, pointing out that they're doing the same thing wrongly about carbon dioxide emissions. Nonetheless, sadly, EEN continues the campaign and has added support for CO2 emission reductions to its list of so-called pro-life causes. Incidentally, a year ago, George Soros' New America Foundation commissioned and published a major study trying to explain why, despite over 25 years and hundreds of millions of dollars trying to green American evangelicalism and enlist evangelicals in the climate alarmist movement, the result had been almost total failure. Their conclusion for why? Largely that the Cornwall Alliance's efforts at communicating the truth about climate change to evangelicals had defeated them with hardly any funding. That's their assessment. Well, let me conclude with a call to arms, to spiritual arms, in spiritual warfare. This is what we face. We face the prospect of an increasingly powerful UN dominated by pagan religionists backing an agenda for global wealth redistribution, engineered and enforced by global government and justified by the need to avert a global environmental crisis, belief in which depends not on real science but on irrational, mystical, post-normal science, used to intimidate a gullible world into submission to a comprehensive worldview that is anti-Christian and ipso facto anti-real science. But liberty and property and the maintenance of national sovereignty and government by consent of the governed and real science with its technologies have delivered the developed world and can deliver the rest of the world from abject poverty. Christian faith, political liberty, and respect for life and property have delivered the Western world from serfdom and tyranny. And Christian faith and real science stand or fall together. And the Green Movement, using the UN as its mechanism and aided by its allies in the news and entertainment media, in every Western, not to mention developing world, government, and in public education, is intent on destroying all of those and replacing them with paganism, global socialism, biological egalitarianism that demeans human life and seeks to reduce our numbers by 95%, and post-normal, that is, pseudo-science, all serving a political agenda that leads to global tyranny. We need to wake up the Christian church to this threat and find ways to defeat it. We need to be like the men of Issachar, who, we're told in 1 Chronicles 12:32, understood their times to know what Israel should do. Well, what can we do? First, know and teach the word. Many passages of Scripture can help people see through the false claims of environmentalism and understand, reclaim, and fulfill the blessed mandate of Genesis 1:28. The Scriptures are a treasure trove of instruction about appreciating and caring for God's earth and fulfilling the dominion mandate. To learn more, not only about Scripture, but also about science and economics related to environmental issues, sign up for Cornwall Alliance's email newsletter at our new website, cornwallalliance.org. Read the many scholarly papers and articles there. Encourage your church members and friends to do likewise. And pray for us and invite me or other Cornwall speakers to speak at other places. Second, do the word. Read the word, preach the word, do the word. How? Well, some of you might get your churches involved in local earth stewardship programs, like working with local residents to clean up vacant lots in inner city slums and turn them into community gardens, which is a great opening for evangelism. Or helping people save energy and money by caulking or insulating leaky houses or church buildings. But frankly, America is already pretty clean and safe by historical standards and compared with poor countries around the world. So some of you might want to help the poor in developing countries, for example, by resisting the pressure to adopt climate and energy policies that would slow, stop, or reverse economic development, especially in developing nations, trapping billions in severe poverty for generations to come. Come to our website and sign our petition, Forget Climate Change, Energy Empowers the Poor. Third, I would plead with you to support the Cornwall Alliance financially. We operate on a shoestring, literally. But and finally, we all need to pray for each other and for the church around the world to gain and to put into practice sound understanding of the biblical, theological, scientific, economic, and other aspects of godly dominion to reclaim the blessings of Genesis 1:28. And I would like to offer at this point, first of all, I'd be glad to field some questions if there are some, but also I have a number of copies of a new booklet that we just published called Understanding Global Temperature, a Guide to Understanding Global Temperature Data by Dr. Roy Spencer. He's a senior fellow of the Cornwall Alliance and one of the world's leading climate scientists. I would like to offer one free copy of that to everybody here. And if you will promise to give copies of that to science teachers at local schools around here, you may take up to, say, 5 more free copies with you as well. I'll get those out of my briefcase when we're done with Q&A time. So it's a great educational tool, and the vast majority of science teachers around the country really do not know what is going on in this. So, questions? Questions? Way back there. So,
what role does the work of Francis Schaeffer fit into some of the folks who work with Cornwall? He was against the environmental movement, but also was in favor of Christian dominion.
Yeah. Schaeffer, for one thing, is one of my great heroes. I love his work. His one real contribution on this subject was his book Pollution and the Death of Man, which came out, I think, in 1968, something like that. Very early, you know, much earlier than the vast majority of evangelical environmentalists of later times even began to think about the subject. So he was in that respect very, very forward-looking. Schaeffer is wonderful in apologetics and in all sorts of other things. And he was wonderful in calling us to the importance of recognizing the biblical call to be good stewards of the earth. However, in that book, Pollution and the Death of Man, Schaeffer essentially accepted, without applying 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test all things, hold fast what is good, a whole lot of the empirical claims of environmental degradation at face value. Now, it's not that those claims were false whole cloth, but the vast majority of them were badly exaggerated. Second, the sorts of claims that he was looking at in that book were claims about what we would today call traditional pollutants, okay? Carbon monoxide, lead, sulfur dioxide, and things like that, chemical runoff from agricultural chemicals, things of that sort. Real pollutants doing real harm, but they were almost always very local in their impact. And so, although generally the claims were exaggerated, they were still true at root, at bottom. And the movement of that period, of the 50s, 60s, early 70s, I think did a lot of good. It did bring attention to real problems, and we focused attention then in terms of regulation and technology on solving those real problems, and the vast majority of those real problems in industrialized countries hardly exist anymore. You know, I mean, you had the Cuyahoga River catching fire because of all the chemicals in it back in, what was it, 19... Now I can't remember the year, but nothing like that. Lake Erie was practically dead. Today, it's full of fish again. It's wonderful. So we solved those sorts of problems. Now, Schaefer focused on those in Pollution and the Death of Man, and a bunch of evangelical environmentalists now claim the mantle of Schaefer, but they shift the mantle over to looking at things like tropical deforestation, species extinction, ozone depletion, human-made climate change, things like that, which frankly, Schaefer wasn't thinking about at all. Nobody was thinking about them at the time that Schaefer wrote his book. So you've got a situation where people take the theological and moral stature of Schaefer and apply it to other ideas, I think, quite sadly. Now, Schaefer's role in Cornwall Alliance, well, insofar as he has strongly influenced the thinking, especially of most of the theologians and pastors who are part of the Cornwall Alliance, you know, his whole thinking about general Christian apologetics, cultural apologetic, Christian role in culture, things like that, that shapes us very heavily. But frankly, he was not about the scientific and economic answers to the environmental challenges. That wasn't what he worked on. And so there's not a lot of influence from there. Is that clear enough? Okay. Right here.
There's one area that you touched on a few times regarding the foundation of science that we have seen flourish in Western Europe.
Uh-huh.
That is the Christian idea that the
yes.
universe is orderly.
Yes.
Created by an orderly God.
Yeah.
Am I correct in assuming there are a few works on the website that address that?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, last night I was mentioning to, what's your name again?
Matt.
Yeah, Matt, that a few years ago I did a paper for a colloquium, a scholar's colloquium up at the University of Western Ontario. And I think that the title of it was something like How Theology Can and Should Inform the Debate Over Catastrophic Anthropogenic Global Warming, you know, the debate over climate change, okay? That paper is available in its entirety on our website. It's a fairly lengthy paper, and a pretty lengthy portion of it early on goes into that very subject, citing a lot more different scholars on it than just Whitehead and Rodney Stark. That's there. Okay. Yes, sir.
Thank you for the chance to be a little older to understand the changes that has taken place in the health of this country.
Remember that.
The environment. When I'm 82 years old, and I remember when I lived in Los Angeles, in school, I couldn't stand right outside, my eyes burned.
Yep.
I went into my classes, eyes burned. It was terrible. Go out there.
I grew up there.
You grew up there?
Yep. It was awful.
In Los Angeles?
Yeah, Alhambra and Huntington Beach.
I played for Alhambra.
Yeah.
Now I go out there, and it's amazing the changes that take place. I mean, it's horrible, all these cars, not because of the
smog.
The gas is so much, it's just too many cars.
Yeah. Traffic on the highway. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, when we moved there in June of 1966, we moved to Alhambra, which you probably will remember, is about 12 miles from the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains. And so here are these mountains that rise up to over 7,000 feet, just, you know, 12 miles from us. We moved there in June of 66. We never saw the mountains until November.
That's right.
When, for the first time, the fall rains came through and cleared the sky enough that we could see them. That's how dense the smog was. We lived there for 3 years. We had to move out of there because my sister's lungs were so sensitive to the smog that it was literally putting her at risk of death. So we moved down to Huntington Beach, 3 miles from the beach, where the air was a little bit, anyway. And now, all over the LA basin, all of the Orange County and Riverside and San Bernardino area, the air is mostly pretty clear, but now we have a real blight on the area. A couple of years ago, my wife and I did a trip where I was doing a whole series of lectures all up the West Coast, and we first flew to Phoenix to see some family and friends, and then we rented a car and we drove from there over to LA. And I don't know how many of you have ever driven across Interstate 10 from Phoenix to Los Angeles, but as you're driving through the desert between past Palm Springs and all that area, you come to a pass where, when you're westbound, on your left is Mount San Jacinto, which rises to almost 10,000 feet. On your right side is Mount San Gorgonio, which rises to almost 12,000 feet. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And you are down on the desert floor at, you know, a couple hundred feet above sea level. And it's just this incredible pass. And I used to be a truck driver out there, and I drove that route 3 times a week. And it was beautiful in the 1979, the year that I was doing that. And I always looked forward to that. There's a spot where you come over a rise, and for the first time you can see down into this lower area ahead of you. We topped that, and I looked ahead, expecting to see the beautiful view that I had seen so many times before. And instead, I saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of wind turbines destroying the entire vista. And I confess to you that I didn't only cry, but I also cursed. I kind of lost some of my sanctification. I was so angry. And that was done in the name of environmentalism. No self-respecting environmentalist of the 1960s or 70s could ever have embraced that. It's just absurd. I think it's really sad. And of course, it doesn't help solve the energy problem at all, because making energy from wind is so much more expensive than making it from coal and natural gas and nuclear and hydro. It's really a sad thing. Okay. Yeah.
Another word we hear all the time is sustainability.
Yes.
I didn't hear you mention that at the top. How does it relate to what you're critiquing?
Yeah. The whole sustainability movement, I mean, it goes back to Gro Harlem Brundtland, the former Prime Minister of Sweden, and the Brundtland Commission of the United Nations in 1974? I'm not sure the year, but they put out a major report on sustainability, and the idea is that whatever we're doing now should be something that every generation will be able to continue to do. That is, we should not diminish the ability of any future generation to do what we're doing by what we're doing, right? Now, that's literally absurd, because we can't guess what the technologies of even one generation from now are going to be, let alone 10 or 20 generations. I mean, who in the year 1916 would have been able to figure out that by 2016, France would have over 80% of its electricity coming from nuclear power plants? I mean, for crying out loud, in 1916, hardly any of France had any electricity at all, period. And nobody had yet figured out how to crack the atom. Nobody had figured out how to do nuclear energy. Now, there were a few nuclear physicists who were starting to theorize about that maybe someday it would become possible, but nobody knew how to do that. So the sustainability movement has basically become a rationale for government control over everything you do. And it's especially strong in American universities. Almost all the universities have their sustainability programs. One of Cornwall Alliance's adjunct scholars is the environmental manager for the Texas A&M University Center system, and you know he's not fooled by the sustainability thing at all, and he's done a great deal of research into it. He's written some stuff for us about it, but also an organization called the National Association for Scholars has done a whole series of major articles and reports on the sustainability movement in American higher education. It's an incredible waste of money, and it's just about as unscientific as you can imagine. It's very sad. What the sustainability people don't recognize is all the incentives involved in economics. They don't recognize that as technologies change, as resource supplies change and so on, people change their behavior in response to changing prices. But they screw up the price mechanism through government manipulation of the economy so that those prices can't give the information that they otherwise would use. So, you know, the head bone's connected to the neck bone and eventually down to the foot bone, you know? All of those things tie together.
You spoke about the community gardens, which I agree with.
Uh-huh.
I have a dear friend, he's on the left, and I heard him speak, I had a place where he was speaking, and we've been friends for years, Ed Fowler, he ran for governor, and a lot of you guys probably know him. And after he got done, some of the things he said was right. And I was telling Ed, I says, have you noticed that? I says, I know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we had bad air here in the office. We do not have bad air anymore. He didn't question that at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he had some things right, some things wrong.
Yeah. I would remark about the community gardens idea. A lot of different environmental, evangelical environmental organizations talk about doing community gardens in slums, you know, taking an abandoned lot or whatever and cleaning it up, getting rid of all the broken glass and empty bottles and cans and stuff like that, and then planting it as a garden and working along with the people who live right next to it. That's a great idea so far as outreach is concerned, okay? It's a lousy idea so far as the expense of getting food on the plates of these people. The cost per unit of food put on the table, when you remember the value of the man hours that go into it, is very high. But that's not a reason not to do it. If you realize that your proper reason for doing these community gardens is instead a little bit of environmental cleanup in the community, but more importantly, the impact on the lives of the people that get involved in doing that, changing lives, and especially building the relationships through which you can communicate the gospel of Jesus Christ to these people. Many of them are converted, and then you can disciple them. That's the value of it. But unfortunately, most of the environmental organizations push it as, this is how we're going to promote more food availability for the inner city slums. No, I mean, it's so much cheaper to just buy the food and bring it in. No. I'm going to have to make this the last question. I need to get to the airport fairly soon. So, Brian, it's yours.
Cal, would you say that the environmentalist basically has an insatiability with respect to his goals? For example, here in Iowa, when I was a kid...
That's inherent in the meaning of environment, after all. Everything.
Well,
surroundings.
When I was a kid, we might get 120 bushels per acre of corn production.
Yeah.
And the water quality, since then, the last 40 years, the water quality has improved dramatically.
Yep.
And now we're doing 240 bushels per acre in production. So we've doubled our productivity and cleaned up the water. It's not good enough. The city of Des Moines is suing three counties in northwest Iowa for nitrate runoff. And their admitted goal is to try to get the federal government in to regulate all this.
And of course, that's crazy. I mean, I'll pick up on the tail end of your comment there. That's crazy in that whatever the federal government does winds up having nationwide application, whereas the situation that you've described, even if it is as bad as the environmentalists claim, is a local situation, and it should be dealt with at the state level or even the county level, something like that. This actually ties into another part of how most of the environmental movement works, and particularly the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. They apply what they call the linear no threshold model of toxicity, right? Now, the linear no threshold model says that if 10,000 parts per million of a particular chemical in water supply results in such and such a quantity of risk, we'll just call that quantity for the moment 10, right? Then 1,000 parts per million will result in a tenth of that, that is one risk, right, out of that population. And 100 parts per million will result in a tenth risk, right? The problem is that with pretty much all chemicals, I throw the pretty much in there only because it's always possible that eventually we'll find one to which this doesn't apply, but so far we haven't, okay? For all the ones that we know, toxicity starts at some level, and below that level, it's non-existent, all right? So linear no threshold says your toxicity is going to go on a line like this, a straight line. Whereas the classic toxicology approach says that it goes in a hyperbolic curve. You have pretty much no effect until you reach a certain level, and then it rises fairly rapidly after that. Well, a linear no threshold model of toxicity allows you always to demand a lower and lower and lower emission rate and ambient concentration rate for any given chemical that you're talking about. Even though it might be, it might cost 10,000 times as much to cut from 1,000 parts per million to 100 parts per million as it did to cut from 10,000 parts per million to 1,000. So the result is that you are constantly increasing the cost of achieving less and less benefit. Yeah, that's the environmental movement all over the place.
It's great work if you can get it.
Yeah. All right. Well, I thank you very much. I'm going to open my briefcase. Anybody who wants to take a copy of the little booklet, Understanding Global Temperature Data, you're welcome to take it. If you promise that you will give it to a local school science teacher, you can take additional copies, up to 5 per person. Okay? Thanks a whole lot.
Thank you very much.
Have a closing word of prayer. Let's pray together. Lord, our God, maker of heaven and earth, pray that thou wouldst bless us out of Zion. We give thee thanks for this time this morning. We ask, Lord, that thou wouldst cause us to know thee, know thy words, and walk therein. We do pray for safety.